This is episode 11 of the Mentoring Developers Podcast.
Welcome to Mentoring Developers, the podcast for new and aspiring software developers, where we discuss your struggles, anxieties, and career choices. And now, here's your host, Arsalan Ahmed.
Hey everybody, welcome to part two of my interview with Daryl Miller. If you listened to part one of the interview, you would have noticed that Daryl has a very unique style, he has a very unique story, and he has really good advice for people starting out and also experienced developers. So I hope that you enjoyed part one and that you're going to continue listening to part two of my interview with Daryl Miller. Without further ado, here's Daryl. Previously on Mentoring Developers. So yes. I wanted to ask you about your motivation, because you're talking about these very advanced topics, but you're building very, you know, you're talking about Battleship Gray, you're building things that for your clients, they don't care. They really don't care how you do it, but you're doing it in modern ways.
Okay.
So what's your motive? Why are you doing that? And what's your motivation?
One word, change. You see, we have to constantly deal with change. And the problem of business systems, it used to be really, really easy when you could build a business system where all the data for that business application was stored on that one computer, and the person who was sitting in front of it was editing that whatever accounting application, whatever it was, they had the data and they were the only one looking at it. As soon as we got into networks, local area networks within businesses, where the data was not on the computer that the person was working on, it was on some shared file server, and now we had multiple users all accessing that same data, everything changes at that point, because now you have contention, you have concurrency issues insofar as, well, am I looking at out-of-date information? I've got two users both trying to edit the same piece of information, and then we have to control that information. So now all of a sudden, we need to have some code on the server and some code on the client in order to orchestrate the ability for more than one person to work on a centralized piece of data. Now, it's specifically relevant in a business scenario and less so in a consumer scenario, because let's take consumer scenarios. Is I'm building a to-do list. Well, it's my to-do list, and nobody else is going to look at my to-do list. I have a calendar application. I might be out in the cloud, but it's only me looking at it. In a business-type scenario, you've got inventory information that maybe there are multiple order entry clerks that are consuming information from inventory. You've got people who are ordering material, and you may have multiple purchasing people. Well, you don't want them to be purchasing the same thing. You've got people releasing work out into the shop floor. There's all kinds of concurrency issues because all the people in that company are all trying to work on the same set of that same set of data and manipulate that same set of data. So over the years, we've tried a number of different ways of balancing where the logic should go, how much logic should we have on the server, how much logic should we have on the client, and we keep flipping backwards and forwards as to where we should put all the data. If we go back to the days of mainframe computers, all the logic used to be on the servers, and the only thing that got reflected down to the client was just kind of a green screen with some fields to enter. And then we moved into the PC era, and we moved all of the logic onto the clients, and the only thing on the server was a file server. We used ISAM databases that really was just a file, and we held locks open And we just read the bytes over the wire, and then the clients did all of the work there. But we needed to have record locking so that you didn't have two people editing the same information. And then that had scalability issues. So then we introduced client-server databases, where we moved a big chunk of the data processing back onto the server, but we kept the UI manipulation on the client. So then we were kind of in a hybrid situation. Then we moved to the web, and the web moved all of the work back onto the server, and the only thing, it was almost back to green screen mainframe days, where we only had like HTML on the front end, and all the work is on the back end. So it keeps going backwards and forwards, because we can't figure out what is the right balance. Because what happens is, as soon as you have code on both the client and on the server, they need to be in sync a little bit, right? And they need to be talking about the same data structures, and they need to be talking about the same pieces of information. And if you make a change, it's easy to make a change on the server side. You can make that very quick because that's only in one place. But now we have to also synchronize and make sure all the clients understand that that change has just been made. So maybe we need to do updates to all of the clients. And I'll go back to a very specific time in probably around about 2006. I was working on this ERP software, and we had punch clocks out on the shop floor that were using embedded XP-type operating systems. And we were using handheld scanners that had Windows CE, and we were communicating backwards and forwards using SOAP to make requests backwards and forwards from these client devices to the server devices to the server. And we had logic on the server, because that was where it made sense to make some of these business decisions close to where the data was. That was the most efficient place for it. So I had an update to do with the .NET framework, and I updated the .NET framework, and that triggered, oh, you also need to update the SOAP toolkit that you're using. And guess what? All of a sudden, that broke a bunch of my clients. Well, updating the XP embedded, I had to update the .NET framework or some library on it. If I needed to update that, I had to send the device back to the manufacturer to get it to be updated. And as far as that $2,700 handheld scanner, you can't update the OS, the Windows CE OS, on that thing. So all of a sudden, it just kind of dawned on me, is we have this amazing amount of coupling between the client and the server that is completely unnecessary, because all I was trying to do was add one new feature that I needed the new .NET framework for, and there was this massive cascading effect. And that's what led me to looking at HTTP. And saying, look, this is a protocol for building distributed applications. It's worked really well for the web, and they haven't changed this protocol in a very long time. So how is it that we are able to build all the stuff on the web, and yet what seems like even the slightest change in my business system seems to have all these cascading effects around? And that's when I started to learn about REST. And REST was a description of the constraints that were used in defining HTTP in order to build systems that could evolve, where you have different components that exist in a distributed system, and those components need to be able to evolve independently. And if you follow a certain set of rules when you're building your software, like we were talking about before, it doesn't really matter what language you're using. As long as you have the right patterns and you use the right approaches, the software will be maintainable. Well, if you follow the correct rules, and you follow these constraints, you'll build systems that can evolve and can change. And that is what pushed me towards completely redesigning our ERP system to use this much more flexible model, so that I could change various components of our system independently without causing these cascading effects around. Because the one thing that the cascading effects do once you move into a business environment is they lock you down. All of a sudden, you can't update this component because you know it will affect this component, and for some reason, we can't change that component. I've run into it in other companies that I've worked for where the deployed software out to multiple different customers. It's been a multi-tenant type of scenario, and we've wanted to update the server component to provide some feature for one customer, but then another customer said, well, no, you can't do updates at the moment. We're busy doing our year end, so we don't want you to touch any of our client stuff. So because there was the coupling between the client and the server, we couldn't. So now all of a sudden we had to start managing multiple different versions simultaneously on the server and dealing with all the orchestration issues there. So managing change is huge in software. And I started out by saying one of the things I loved about software was the fact that you can change it and go back and fix things. So as soon as you start introducing things that stop me from changing software, I don't like doing it anymore. And that's really where the whole drive for learning how to build vulnerable systems has come about.
Now let's join part two of the interview with Daryl Miller. I think this is fantastic. Even if you're working on an application that is for an enterprise, for a traditional company, you can still use modern concepts, because a lot of times, I shouldn't say modern concepts, but I should say proven concepts, because they may not be modern. HTTP is not modern, but the way we're using it is proven, and if we can use it to solve a problem, we should do that. And I think for new developers, for people who don't have that experience, maybe they haven't gone through the pain of using SOAP services, and they don't know, when you talk about evolving your client and your server separately, maybe they're not really sure what that means. So what we can say to them is that if you use this thing called RESTful services, which is also, you can also call it HTTP services, but REST implies a certain discipline that HTTP is free for all, right?
It applies some additional constraints upon HTTP, although it is really the way HTTP is supposed to be used in order to build evolvable systems. But maybe evolution isn't critical for you. Maybe you're building a system where you've got two servers in your data center and they're talking to each other in as fast a possible way. And if you need to do an update to one, you can easily do the update to the other, in which case evolvability is not a concern. To bring it to a more modern example, I think mobile apps are by far the best example. You have if you have coupling between your client API and your mobile app, and you make a breaking change on the server, you've got to go through a client update that could require going through the app store to push a new update. And if you're working on multi-platform, you might have to go through, you know, the iOS, the Apple App Store. You've got to go through Google. You've got to go through Microsoft Store. That all of a sudden is a lot of friction in order to deploy a new client application. So there's a lot of incentive there to build systems where they are completely decoupled or very loosely coupled, should I say.
And in cases where you have a service that you want people to use across different devices, perhaps they can open up a browser and go log into the website and see the data, and then later on go to their iPhone or the iPad or the Android device, and they see the same data reflected. So you need a common backend, and RESTful services or HTTP services provide the ideal technology for that, because it is interoperable, and you don't need special client software, and you don't need to create this client proxy. I think a lot of people use client proxies and SOAP services because of the comfort in having a compiled proxy where you're less likely to make mistakes and you don't have to deal with raw data coming back. So then earlier we were talking, you weren't talking to me, but you were talking to, perhaps it was, I think, 2013 or thereabouts, you were giving an interview about SDKs or not using SDKs, not providing an SDK for your REST services, because I think that you have a good point there. But I don't know if you want to talk about it for a minute about what are the challenges that you will have when you are building a REST service. Then you will also need to care about how the REST service is used and some people want, you know, software development kits, or some people want a little bit more handholding, but you don't agree with that.
Well, the thing is, you have, whenever you build a distributed system with a client and server, there's going to be some kind of coupling in order to, for the two systems to interact. The client needs to know something about the server. So the question is, what does it need to know about the server in order to interact? The idea, or a lot of the principles behind HTTP, are that you have a fairly loose interaction model where it's standardized with the methods of get, put, post, but they could mean slightly different things. And you have messages that come back that say, oh, by the way, this came back from that request that you just sent. And if you look at the metadata, you can find out what it is that came back from the server. So it is a fairly loosey-goosey kind of contract between the client and the server that is flexible. But in order to take advantage of that contract, you need to understand a little bit about how HTTP works. And there's a certain amount of reluctance, right? And understandably, because software developers are coming into things going, I have all this stuff to learn. What should I learn and what shouldn't I learn? And the idea of learning the guts of HTTP when there's this shiny new framework that says it will do everything for me doesn't seem all that appealing. But once you actually get to learn that HTTP protocol and how to use it and how it works, the nice thing is it kind of can be applied to other HTTP APIs that are doing different things. Like, you can reuse that learning and it doesn't change. When it comes to, so in reaction to people's kind of objection to learning the details of HTTP, API vendors and API providers, in an attempt to encourage people to come and use their API, have said, okay, well, that's okay. We'll provide a library, and our library will just kind of, we'll do all HTTP goop for you, and we'll just provide you with a bunch of functions that you can call. And people go, hey, this is great. I know how to call a function in my particular language, and they use it. But I said before, you know, between client and server, there's a point of coupling. Well, you just move that point of coupling. You're no longer coupling on HTTP, which is a protocol that hasn't changed in 15 years. You're now coupling on a procedural library that is at version 0.9.4. And 0.9.7 might have a breaking change in it. And it might also have a new feature that you need. So you have to make a decision as to whether or not you're going to upgrade your application to get that new feature and then fix all of the related stuff related to that breaking change. So you have now coupled against that library that the consumers, that the API provider has provided. And there's pros and cons to it. Yes, it does provide a simpler, more familiar interface. But when I go to use another API, well, you've got to learn a whole new client library that API provider is, that has different conventions, and it does authentication a different way, and it uses the method slightly differently, and it has a whole different way of building a object graph, and it's amazing how different people can build client SDKs over the top of HTTP, which is actually all consistent, so you don't get that same reuse from one API library to another. And you also have this situation where when somebody's built that client library, they had to make all kinds of assumptions about how you wanted to deal with failure conditions. And maybe what they perceive as a failure condition that is fatal isn't a failure condition that's fatal for you. The example I always give is like with an image. All right, so you're returning a resource. If the purpose of your client is to crawl that API and find all the images that are in that system, if one of the image URLs happens to be a 404, well, it's not the end of the world. You move on to the next one. Or let's say it's an image that's displaying on a toolbar or a menu or something like that. If it's not there, okay, it's not the end of the world. Your client application still be functional. But if your client application's job is to do image processing and the user said, please go and get this image so I can do image processing on it, if you can't find it, you can't perform the function of the client application. So client libraries have to, are forced to make decisions about how to deal with failure conditions. And all of a sudden, you as a person building an application that uses that client library have to live with the decisions that the API provider makes. And if you're building an edge case type scenario, that library may not work for you. If you go directly against the HTTP, yeah, there's a little learning up front, but you have a lot more control, a lot more flexibility, and you can reuse that learning when you go and work with other HTTP APIs. So client libraries are, there's ways of doing it. And I've been working on a project which I call, it's called HappyKit. It's on GitHub, which I'm experimenting with a number of different client tooling to help build client libraries that are more flexible, that don't lock you into any particular style of using them, and can also work well with hypermedia responses, or responses that come back with links in them, so that you're not, you don't have to construct URLs, or you don't have to necessarily know in advance all of the URLs that exist in an API. So that's one of the, my projects that I'm working on, that kind of tooling to try and kind of find a happy medium between not giving any API tooling at all and providing this wrapper library that fixes everything down and doesn't give any flexibility.
That's really interesting. I was trying to search for it. What's it called? HappyKit.
It's HappyKit.github.com.
Okay. All right. So we'll make sure that this is in the show notes.
And it's a work in process. So it's really based a lot on a number of other open source libraries that I've built in the past. But I built them very fine grained, and it became such a labor intensive task to manage all the NuGet packages, all the interdependencies between the packages. And I was like, okay, if I'm going to keep building stuff, I'm going to spend more time like maintaining the packages and actually writing any code. So a lot of them I just merged into this single HappyKit project, which is still fairly small. So and it's a portable library, so it can work on any of the .NET platform.
Okay, so I can imagine there are a lot of people out there, they got a lot of out of this interview, and they're thinking, this REST thing sounds really interesting, but it's also very intimidating. So where do you think they should go to learn more about it, how to do HTTP services using REST tools, technologies? And I heard that you wrote a book about that.
Yes. Well, I mean, I was involved. I helped out. I was on the advisory board with Microsoft's Web API project. So Web API is their framework for building on ASP.NET, HTTP web APIs. The parts that I contributed towards the book were fairly technology agnostic. I was talking about media type design, and I have a chapter on working with HTTP client, which is the .NET client for making HTTP requests. But there's a lot of good information in there. There are a number of other good books. One that I really like, and somebody needs to do an updated version of this, is the RESTful Web Services Cookbook. And it literally, are you familiar with the Gang of Four Patterns book?
Oh, yeah.
Right, so this is kind of like the Gang of Four Patterns book, but for HTTP. It says, well, if you want to do this in a web API, then this is the pattern that you can use. This is the interaction model. And so, somebody really needs to create another book like that that just goes through a whole bunch more scenarios of patterns in HTTP. Anyway, the cookbook is a good book.
It has 4.5 stars, 26 reviews on Amazon.
Yeah. The updated RESTful Web Services book by Mike Amundsen and Leonard Richardson is another great book. It's a sequel to the original RESTful Web Services by Sam Ruby and Leonard Richardson. That's another great book to get. But this is probably really terrible advice, but you know what? Reading the RFC 7230, 7231, the RFC, the HTTP specs, it takes a little while to get used to reading that material because of the way the material's organized, because of the terminology that's used. But if you're going to build applications on the web, on the internet, learning how to read IETF specifications is worth its weight in gold. I find so much material in those specifications that has been really well thought out, and the justification and the reasoning are usually in those specs, and they're not the most interesting reading, and they, as I say, they do take a bit of time to get used to, but it's one of those skills, if you can learn to read those comfortably, that will serve you tremendously.
So these RFCs are these documents that IETF produces that are...
Well, hold on. Technically, no. See, okay. The IETF is a really interesting standards body in that there is really no membership. Anybody can contribute towards the IETF. You can go to anywhere where you can create a web page, and you can create a spec, and you can go and join any of the mailing lists in the different working groups. There's no membership at all. And you can say, look, I've created this spec, and what do you think of it? And they will give you feedback on it. Now, there are recommended formats for how to actually do these specs. And they start out with what's called an internet draft, right? So you create this document that you say is an internet draft. And the reason for these templates is there's just certain ways that they do things. And if you follow the template, then, you know, you'll conform to all of the standard boilerplate type stuff. But then once you present that to the working group, you'll get a bunch of people who've been doing this for a very long time who'll read your spec and go, nah, you shouldn't say that. Oh, you're missing this. Oh, you need to say that. And you'll get technical feedback from some really, really smart people. And at that point, if it serves a real valuable purpose, then it can actually move into a more formal standards track. If it's just accepted as, yes, we understand the value of this, then the idea is, the idea behind the IETF is you need two working implementations of a particular spec before it can move on to the next stage. But even if you don't take your specification that far, just the process of formally documenting a particular idea. Let's say you're building something and you decide, I need to send some metadata along with this. Maybe I could put it in an HTTP header. And you can write a spec that just says, okay, I think we need an HTTP. Here's a good example. Nobody's actually gone and written a correlation ID. What can sometimes happen is you make a bunch of requests and the requests are related to each other. And maybe we should have a standardized header name that we put some kind of GUID in it, and all the requests that are related to each other should all have that GUID in the header. And I'm waiting for somebody to come along and actually write the spec that says we should call it this, and this is what it should contain, and this is what its purpose is, and people are going to go, yeah, we love it. Okay, that's cool. Let's all do that. And it requires no money other than your time, and it requires no official sign up or anything. You just get involved, and that's one of the reasons I love the IETF so much more than a lot of the other standards bodies. That are a lot of the stuff happens in closed meetings. A lot of the stuff requires fairly hefty membership fees in order to participate, whereas the IETF doesn't. That's my little sales pitch on the IETF. I've started at conferences. If they do lightning talks, I'll do a 5-minute talk on why we should care about the IETF. So you got that here.
You really got me excited about it. I opened the page and I was like, oh, okay, that's cool. Because the idea of reading an RFC just scares me.
Oh, yeah. And you know, it did for me. And you know, the first one that I really, really went into in any depth was RFC 6570, which is URI templates. So URI templates is a specification that allows you to put parameters inside, create a little template for building a URI and parameterizing it. and there's some weird rules in there, and you can put strange characters, and it was like, okay, I kind of understand part of it. And I was like, I want to write a library that does this, right? So I'd read it, and I'm like, okay, I started. And then I got to one of the appendices, and it's like, oh, by the way, here's an algorithm of how you implement it. I'm like, whoa, okay, cool. Okay, so I just followed the algorithm along, and I converted it into C#, and step by step, and it's a single pass where it just walks through the characters in this URI template and does a substitution of the parameter tokens with the parameter value. And then the end result is you have a valid URI with the parameters passed in. And I learned so much in that process, just in trying to figure out how to write this little library and going back to the spec and going, okay, well, what are they saying here? And all of the IETF specs use a special syntax for describing structures called ABNF, which is augmented backhouse NOR format, which is another format that just, it's weird at first, but once you've dug into a few different specs and you read about it, it's a little weird syntax, but you get used to it. It's not that painful eventually. But they have a very fairly rigorous mentality about only saying anything once. They're very dry. So instead of saying something again, they'll point to another spec. So when you're trying to read one spec, you'll probably end up with like 5 browser pages open, where you're trying to read all these different specs and conglomerate all that information, which is a pain in the butt until you start to get used to some of the base ones. And then at that point, it's like, oh, well, yeah, I've read that thing before. I know that. And so then all of a sudden, over time, it just gets easier and easier to read them because you're familiar with the specs that they're referring to and go, oh, yeah, I know what that spec's all about. So it has been one of the most valuable things that I've done in the last 10 years. Insofar as getting used to being able to read those, and the amount of useful information I've found in there is tremendous.
I think that just also goes to show your dedication. I mean, you have to have some passion for a thing. It's good because you were mentioning that people shouldn't restrict themselves to a particular type of technology. They should broaden their horizons, and I think that's really good, really important, but at some point, you have to focus on something if you want to go at any depth, and you certainly have, right? It's not, yeah. This is not bedtime reading.
No, it's not. And I realized one of the reasons why I really was attracted to that is, as a developer, I've worked for a number of companies and worked for myself for a long time. So I always tended to end up being the most senior developer on the team. So I never really had somebody to go and ask questions to. So I ended up trying to figure stuff out always on my own. And that's why I've made a lot of mistakes and learned the hard way many, many, many times. So when I was presented with this, here's a bunch of really smart people that made all of their work available for free, and all you have to do is read it, and then you can just use it in your own applications, and it all fits together, and it all works together in a nice way to build distributed systems that are scalable on the web and can last for years. It's like, you've just answered my prayers there, because now I don't have to be uncertain about things anywhere near as much as I used to, because I didn't know how to do it before.
Let us know how we are doing by tweeting at us at Mentoring Devs. And if you are enjoying the show, give us a 5-star rating on iTunes. Now, let's get back to the show.
Yeah, this is incredible. I think software, being a software developer is so many things, and it requires, you know, focus, it requires dedication, it requires passion, but it requires an open mind, and you can get knowledge from different areas. You can go into hardware development, and that's a whole another field and a whole another set of learning. Another IETF is not going to tell you, you know, how embedded devices work. If you want to learn about internet protocols, you go to this resource. There's a lot to do, and I think that people are going to really benefit from this interview. because they're going to get, you know, get the gist of your experience. We are coming to the end of this interview. It's been going on for a while.
I told you I could talk.
and I would love to talk to you. I'd love to keep you on here for another hour, but I want to respect your time, but we still have a few questions that we want to go through.
Sure.
So let me ask you some questions and you can answer the way you like, but let's try to be succinct and give some pointers to our listeners. I want to know if you think it's important for our developers, for new developers or senior developers to do some self-promotion, to promote themselves, whether online or in events. What do you think about that?
I'm not sure self-promotion is the right term. I think there's a certain amount of paying it forward, insofar as if you go out there and you do talks at conferences and you write blog posts and you contribute to the community, then when you have a question, people will answer you. So there's a value there in making yourself visible, making that people know you, and you'll get people that when you become, you know, if you're experienced in a particular topic, they'll come and ask you for help. But then you can go to them for help when you have something that they may be an expert on. So I think it's really valuable to be a part of the software development community. I've found working on Stack Overflow, I've spent a tremendous amount of time answering Stack Overflow questions, and that has been incredibly beneficial to me, both from the direct learning that I've acquired from trying to answer questions, because many times it'd be like, I'm trying to answer a question that I don't really know, or I think I know, and it's like, before I actually put my name to this and submit it, let's go try it. And then you go, oh no, I didn't think it worked that, oh, I didn't realize it didn't work that way. So I learned so much there. But then also, you know, there's a certain amount of visibility that you get from having a reasonable rep on Stack Overflow also. So I think there's a trade that you do insofar as by promoting yourself and helping out, you get value back.
Okay. And what do you think about mentorship? Do you think that a new developer should seek out a mentor?
I think mentorship is very valuable. As I say, it's something that I would have liked to have a lot more of throughout my career. There's so much knowledge that professional software developers acquire over the years that they could easily pass down to new developers and share experiences and stuff. And we can learn vice versa, right? You know, that there's new things happening all the time that younger developers are more familiar with that could solve problems. There's tools that they're aware of that we didn't know exist that makes life a lot easier. So it goes both ways. I think mentoring is a very valuable activity within, it's all part of the community, right?
Right. So there are several modes of mentorship or several ways mentorship can be accomplished. I think that if you're working in an environment where you have a senior person that's helpful, that could be your mentor informally. There could also be mentorship programs. Some companies have mentorship programs. They have training. They have courses, curriculum. People go through these exercises. And I've seen both, you know, work and not work. So if you can tell us if you think that a regimented, structured mentorship program is a good thing?
The cynic in me would say no, right? I think forced mentorships or coerced mentorships, however you want to Column will eventually be gamed, and they won't work as effectively as they should. Having said that, I, as an independent software developer, have had interns come and work from our local colleges and from universities. And so effectively, I've worked as mentoring them, and it's been part of their course curriculum to spend a term working at a company doing software development work. So I suppose in that aspect, it is useful, but again, the students are doing it because it's part of their course. So it all comes down to whether or not the student is receptive to it or not. I think informally developed mentorship arrangements are probably a lot more effective.
Do you listen to any podcasts or do you watch any screencasts?
I do watch. I always watch Traffic and Weather. Listen to Traffic and Weather, which is John Sheehan and Steve Marks, because I find it hilarious. And it's about APIs, but they don't do very many of them. I occasionally will listen to Herding Code. I would listen to more, but I don't commute to work, so it's kind of, and you know, running with a phone in your pocket is less, you know, is not the easiest thing to do either. So I'll tend to watch screencasts and video stuff whilst running on the treadmill in the wintertime. But no, I don't listen to too many podcasts.
Do you read any blogs?
Yes, I read all kinds of blogs, but I no longer, well, I don't really do the RSS thing anymore. I tend to find blog articles through either Twitter or Stack Overflow references or Slack channels that I'm a member of. Again, it's about somebody who I know and have some kind of trust relationship saying, here's an interesting blog. I don't use like a Feedly account, or although I did recently install an RSS reader on my Windows machine, but like for Windows 10, like there's just really no decent feed readers around anymore. But I went back to Outlook. I've installed like the beta of Windows 10, and I put Outlook 2016, and it has a way of pulling RSS feeds into Outlook, which I don't mind. But most of the RSS readers that I found are really, they just haven't been sticky for me.
Yeah, it's an investment of time. I'm curious about that. You know, you have this RSS aggregator and it brings in a whole bunch of articles, but then you have to spend the time reading it. And it, your time is, well, you get, if you're a consultant, for example, you get paid by the hour. And how do you justify that?
Yeah, it's hard, and I mean, I think it was a case of with feed reader. Eventually, you know, you just get bankruptcy with the feed reader, much like you do with email. And I find Twitter for me is a better way, because if enough people who I follow found an article interesting, eventually it will show up in my feed. I might miss it the first three or four times, but the next time somebody who I follow retweets it, I'll probably see it then. Or if it generates some discussion on Twitter between people that I follow, then I'll trace it back and I'll go and read it at that point.
Yeah, I think
that's the filter for me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, RSS is not the same anymore, and I think that's what everybody is doing. Social media promotions and social media is just so important right now that you can't avoid it. So I know that a lot of my listeners and I know that a lot of new developers are not on Twitter. And it's really unfortunate because you're missing out. If you're not on Twitter, you're not following people like Daryl and other influencers, you're missing out because you're not really learning from their experience and the tweets and retweets that you do. And if you're interested, if you're out there and you're interested in HTTP services, REST services, you should be following Daryl Miller.
Well, let me just add an incentive here. I have got four different jobs. In fact, the only jobs I've been hired to do in the past 10 years have come from conversations initiated on Twitter.
That's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, literally a random person in Montreal, where I live, said on Twitter one day, I need somebody who can do some VBA Excel QuickBooks integration. And I said, well, I can do that. And I went, and it was a very short contract, but I did that work. My work with Ward at IdeaBlade, I met Ward through Twitter, and I found out he was looking for somebody through Twitter.
That's incredible. Yeah. So Twitter is a way now for you to get your news and to get jobs and to also do your learning.
you know what it also is, which is incredibly valuable from a community perspective, is if you've ever been to, you know, a meetup in the evening, or you've gone to a conference and you want to meet people, right? Well, how do you meet people who you don't know, right? It's not easy, especially when you know at conferences there's lots of people who know people. With Twitter, it's easy to slowly get to know somebody without any real commitment. And you can, you know, even if you're just kind of doing the stalking thing, following somebody, you know something a little bit about them. And if you ever meet them face to face, there's a little bit of, you know, a little bit, you can say something, you can mention something that you know has happened to them, or you know something about them that you could, that you maybe have in common. So it's an icebreaker insofar as when you go to community events, you can all of a sudden talk to lots of people who you previously wouldn't know at all, but you can establish relationships with people before ever meeting them face to face. And it makes going to conferences so much easier to actually approach somebody and say, oh, hi, I follow you on Twitter. I saw you talking about this topic the other week, and I thought it was really interesting. And it's the most amazing icebreaker.
Yeah, and a first-hand experience of that, I went to EmberConf, and there was an author. I bought his book, and you know, he's not that well known, but he doesn't know me, and we started talking on Twitter. And so when I went there, I had a chat with him, and that was very nice. And that would never have happened without Twitter.
Absolutely, yeah. It's when used the right way, Twitter is a fabulous tool for professional networking.
Yep. So what's your best advice for software shops that are looking to hire new developers?
Oh, wow. Find them yourself by going and looking for them, I guess. That's a hard question for me to answer. I haven't spent very much of my career going looking to hire people. but I think if you have a particular technology that you work with, here's the best answer to that question. Get used to the idea of hiring remote people. Build an environment where you can hire remote workers. And then you will have no problem finding people to work for you. And you will be able to get great talent. But it requires building the tooling, the ecosystem, the environment that work. I've successfully worked for several companies doing remote work now, and was very successful at it. And I think it worked really, really well. But it has to be organized a certain way. You need the right tools to be able to do it. But that's by far the best way of getting good talent.
And what's your best advice for the other side, the new developer who is looking to get a job?
At this point in time, it's like, if you have spare time, write open source stuff, get involved in open source projects, either start your own or, well, no, both. Start your own and join other ones. I think the experience that you gain there is absolutely invaluable. And even if you don't make it part of your kind of resume, I think the process is you can learn so much by working with open source developers. And there are some out there that are really, really good. So you can learn, you can be, there are open source projects there out there that are run far better than most software projects run within companies. And the other thing is you can actually get involved in a company that maybe you want to work for. I mean, I've submitted stuff to GitHub projects that they have open source. Like if you're a young developer and you're eager and enthusiastic, get involved in one of the GitHub projects and show them what you can do and get involved with the project and then say, by the way, I'm looking for a job. I mean, they're often looking for people to hire, but you could do the same thing with lots of different companies. And if they are the company themselves already have open source stuff out there, then they already see the value of people who contribute towards open source projects. So it's a win-win insofar as you're getting real world experience, you're actually writing software, you're learning stuff. You're building yourself a sort of pseudo CV also with the stuff that's out there. And you never know, the person you're doing work for might also end up hiring you.
Absolutely. And this also plays into the idea of promoting yourself. I know that you don't like the term self-promotion, but if you are on GitHub, people will find you.
Well, yeah, I think you have to work a little bit harder than that. but at least you have some visibility. If somebody goes looking for you, they'll go, oh, yeah, look, he's done this stuff or she's done this stuff on GitHub. And, okay, that code looks interesting. That project looks interesting. And it doesn't have to be GitHub. There's Bitbucket and there's TFS Online and there's, they have public repos. Yeah, okay. There are other source code repositories. I tried to stay away from GitHub for the longest time, but eventually was sucked in because they do community very well. So
yeah, I think that if you want people to know about your projects, and if you want to really make a name for yourself, if that's a goal, and I'm not saying that should be a goal. That's a question I ask my guests to see if they think it should be a goal. But a certain number of people, it is a goal, and that helps to get them visibility. You should be on GitHub. You can also, there's benefits to using other platforms like Bitbucket will give you private repositories and so on.
Sure.
But it doesn't have the community. So it's, you know, you pick the best one for your project. But whatever you do, if it's out there and it's available for public, then you could certainly add it in your resume. And your resume should include, in my opinion, all of your social media outlets, whether it's GitHub or Bitbucket, or perhaps it's your LinkedIn profile. My recommendation for new developers is let people find you in different ways and let your resume or your website, whatever you want people to see, recruiters and so on, you want them to see all of the good things that you have done, right?
Yeah, I mean, it rarely hurts, and generally it helps.
Yeah,
as far as I'm concerned. So, it's there's always that question of if you try searching, Googling for somebody, and you find absolutely nothing, it's like, are they really in the software business? And you know what? The funny thing is, I've had developers work with me who really didn't have any online presence. And they were really good software developers, and they didn't live and breathe software, which is cool, but they were really, really good software developers. It's just really hard to find them.
Yeah. It's hard to find people when there is no point of reference. And I think this is why a lot of people believe that promoting yourself, let's not call it self-promotion. Let's call it promoting your work. So people can find your work, and through your work, they can find about you. in whether it's, you know, in whichever format and whichever platform you use. It's always good because you never know about your current job. You may have a really nice job, but the company may fold, or you may be bored, or you may need to relocate to a new location and you need to start over, and then nobody knows you. So it's really an exciting time, I think, that we can have a great profile on LinkedIn, and we can have a GitHub profile, and we can have some presence outside of your of our geographical area and outside of our resume, and that to give us some credibility.
I think one useful tool, if I were in the kind of student type position now looking for visibility, you go to the Up for Grabs website, which is this website that accumulates all open source projects that have tasks that need to be done that have been tagged as this item is up for grabs. The idea being that it's something that's fairly straightforward for somebody to do. There's no major design decision that still needs to be done, and that the projects want you to actually contribute. They want somebody to contribute that work. And if you were to go to that, you'd probably find some fairly easy, low-hanging fruit type tasks that you can contribute. And you're going to learn so much by just pulling down those projects, getting them to compile, doing the fix, adding the tests, seeing, you know, the configuration management tools that they use in order to do it, and submitting it. You're going to get a lot of good karma from the open source people who are like, oh, we're really happy you grabbed this up for grabs thing. It's going to give you a vast amount of experience. And many of those tasks are probably fairly easy to do.
Yeah, I just went on that website. I didn't know about this. And it looks like there's a lot of .NET projects. Is that a .NET only type of website?
I don't believe it is. It was started by some people who are very active in the .NET community. I believe, kill me if I'm wrong, I think it was Keith Dalby who started that, and Brendan Forster, I think, is involved in it. So that they're .NET-y type guys, but you know, more and more we're you know, we don't want to necessarily be labeled as one particular framework. I think we all are using more and more environments as much as possible. So we're just all software developers, really.
Yeah, I think this interview is the most advice packed and terminology packed episode I've ever done to date, and is
AKA scary. Right?
It is incredible. I am so thrilled. I'm excited, and this is the first time I'm during the interview. I'm going to all these websites, and I'm like, oh my god, I'm excited, and this is amazing. And I think that we really need to make sure that all of these resources, all of those websites and books that you mentioned, that we could include it as part of the show notes. If you know, I'll try to collect as many as I can, but Daryl, if you think of anything that people would benefit from, send it to me. We'll include it in the post.
Sure, no problem at all.
And we're coming to the end of the. I think this will definitely be a two-part interview.
Yeah, you think so?
I think that it's well worth it because it's. I am so excited about this interview. I want you to talk about your work right now. What are you working on? What are your projects, current projects, future projects, or past projects that you want to talk about? And if you are involved in, I know that you are doing not a podcast, but something like a podcast. Let's talk about that and see where can people go to find out about all of the things that you're doing.
Where can they find it? Well, they can find out, they can follow me on Twitter, and they'll see me yakking a lot on Twitter. I have a GitHub repo, which is just Daryl Miller. I have another repo with more kind of official, it's my Tavis-software. Tavis Software is my own company. So those are more official projects. If you search on Nougat for Tavis Star, you'll find all my Nougat packages that I push up there. I currently, as I say, I'm working as an API evangelist for Microsoft. My job is to make life easier for developers to build APIs on top of the Microsoft Azure stack. One of the big products that we have that can do that is the Microsoft Azure API Gateway, or the API Management Service. And the best way of kind of describing that is like, let's say you decide you have this brilliant idea for a product, and it's an API type product, and you run off and you go and you build your API, and I don't care what it's built in. It could be Node.js, it could be Python, it can be Go, I don't care. You build it and you put it up there, and it's like, okay, this is awesome. I know a lot of people are going to want to use this. Now, how do I turn it into a product? How do I control, how do I rate limit to make sure somebody doesn't abuse the service? How do I give API keys to the user? How do I provide a nice kind of portal for developers to sign up for the service and get some documentation? And how do I, you know, if this thing scales, like how am I going to be able to enable caching on the server? All those kind of extra stuff that you need to turn a great idea into a viable product, that's what we can do with Azure API Management. We basically stick the API Management Gateway in front of your API, so the requests come into our gateway, and then we send them on to your API, and we can do all kinds of clever things in the middle there. And in fact, you can add additional code. We built in the Roslyn compiler, so you can write C# code in the gateway to get it to do stuff when the request goes in and get it to do stuff when the request comes out. I've actually been working the last couple of days on a sample and a blog post to show you how to take all the traffic that goes into that into your API through our gateway and feed it off to Azure Event Hubs. And then you can take it from Event Hub and do all kinds of whatever you want, analytics on it. I've actually, the example I'm using, I'm feeding it off to Runscope, going via the Runscope API. So now you get like a real-time logging, debugging, monitoring tool. So as the traffic's flowing through our gateway, going to your backend API, you can sit there looking at the Runscope traffic inspector and see all the requests going by. And you can set up alerts to say, if we ever get 500 returned back, send me a notification in my Slack room or send me an email. So I'm working on those kind of example kind of integrations. So that's the types of things that I'm working on. I'm going to be spending time going to conferences. I'm going to be at API Strategy Conference in Austin in November. I'm going to be at CodeMash in January. And I have a couple of other conferences that I've submitted talks to that hopefully I will be doing a little bit of other traveling, and I'll get to meet people and talk API stuff with them. But other than that, my other really major side project is just trying to build out these client libraries to help people build better client SDKs for their APIs. Currently, all my efforts are in .NET, but once I get the .NET stuff sorted out, I'm hoping to be able to build the same concept in other languages. So between that and just generally family life, my calendar's fairly full.
Fantastic. I think that this interview, I'm super excited. I think you have been an inspiration. You're super nice, which is, I have to say, that it's not very common. And I'm really happy that you're successful. And we've been here for almost 2 hours, and you're still, you know, you're still cheerful. You haven't yelled at me
still
once.
Still yakking.
No, that I think that it's wonderful to have people like you in the industry who are doing it so well. And I think that we look at you as, you know, for inspiration. And we'll definitely want to get in touch with you at CodeMash, which I'll be there as well.
Cool.
And is there anything else you'd like to tell our listeners before we say goodbye?
I don't think so. But don't ever hesitate to come say hello if you ever see me. And if you have an HTTP question, come along and submit it to our In the Mood for HTTP online Q&A that Glenn Block and I are doing. Currently, we're doing it every Monday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. We'll advertise it's on the brownbag.net website. For a few days beforehand, you can just sign in, say you're going to come, and put some questions up. And then on the day we go, people can upvote the questions as to which questions they want answered. And Glenn and I have a laugh trying to answer some of the questions.
Fantastic. And we'll have Glenn Block on the show as well very soon. So we'll have both perspectives. I think I just want to say thank you again and hope to have you back on here, maybe perhaps as part of a panel, and see what you're doing maybe in a year from now.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been fun.
For show notes and transcripts, visit us at mentoringdevelopers.com.